your views. History can have an important place in history. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were created by statute last year, and we were charged with investigating the causes of the collapse or near collapse of major U.S. institutions during the financial crisis. We're also charged with producing a report on our findings to Congress and the American people by December 15th, which is sooner than we'd like it to be.
I have an expert report in that. Big piece of litigation due at 5 o'clock today, so you're in better shape than I am.
All right. Puts it all in perspective. Another part of what we're doing, besides investigating the causes of the collapse and producing the report, is also compiling history, which will be available to folks to look at when they look back. And as part of that process, we're interviewing people that were important part of developing the system that led to the crisis, and people that just have a lot of views because of their history in the industry. You fall into both categories. So we would very much like to preserve your views on tape recorder this morning, which we have done with virtually everyone. Is that okay?
That's fine with me.
Okay, we're going to turn the tape recorder on, and then we're going to get your assent on the tape recorder.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Good morning. It is October 14th, 2010, and the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is here interviewing Richard Breeden, former chairman of the SEC. Mr. Breeden, do you consent to be tape recorded this morning?
Absolutely.
We very much appreciate that. We've given you a little background on the commission, and now I'm going to tell you who we are. My name is Donna Norman, N-O-R-M-A-N.
Milana Vickers. I'm one of the writers with the SEC.
Stephen Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z, also on the writing staff.
Joel Miller with the research group at FCIC.
Mike Easterly, E-A-S-T-E-R-L-Y.
And as I mentioned, we're here with Richard Breeden this morning to get his views on the financial crisis, as well as some historical views. If we could start with a very broad question, which we do with folks, what do you think were the causes of this financial crisis?
Well, I think they are many and varied, and this was a problem that had been building for many years. So part of the challenge that you face is chronicling so many different themes. In one sense, it's easy to say that it was lack of capital in the banking system and the failure of banking supervisors to exercise the powers they had over a long period of time, but particularly in the years as the mortgage bubble grew to and the volume of particularly low quality financial instruments grew and grew. Regulators who had every ability to stop it stood by and watched. And to me, that, you know, the lack of capital, the fundamental over-leveraged condition of the financial system, both banks and broker-dealers, and the coupled with regulators who chose to take a passive approach in the face of the exposures that were being created led to led most directly to the crisis.
Now, do you have any particular regulator or particular decision or event that stands out in your mind in that respect?
Well, I think there are lots of them. I would mention just as background a couple of factors. One, as you noted, I served as chairman of the SEC from 1989 to 1993, and we wrestled with the capital questions then, and I thought I might share some of that history with you because it's reflective of how some of these rules get to be in place as a practical matter and some of their problems. I also, while working as assistant to the president under George Bush Sr., was the person within the White House principally charged with drafting what became known as legislation known as FIREA, which was the restructuring of the savings and loan industry and was a precursor to, in the savings and loan crisis, many of the events that reoccurred later, not really in the savings sector, what was left of it, but second time around in the banking, in the major banks. So that experience, and also during the period when all this was going on from 2002 through 2009, I served on the board of a large Spanish bank called BBVA. And so I, from an outside the U.S. perspective, watched as we would have our board meetings once a month, this crisis unfold, and quite a considerable contrast between, I think, the way the Bank of Spain handled some of these issues in the run-up to this problem and the Federal Reserve's actions. So those are a little bit of the... And, of course, I think I'm the only regulator who pre-Lehman, who actually shut down a troubled non-depository institution in the form of Drexel Burnham when it had its crisis in 1990.
Okay. Thanks, Loretta.
So, anyway, those are some of the backgrounds. Your question, I think, was...
Why don't we give you a minute to doctor your coffee right there, and then if you want to take the things you just mentioned in order. We can start with, if folks want to ask questions about his work on FIREA,
Financial Institutions Reform Regulation Enforcement Act.
And then after you,
we do that. The first thing that you mentioned was discussions of capital requirements.
Right.
But if you want to go in chronological order, that would be when you was at the SEC, and you guys were considering various versions of Basel II, probably. But let's. If we go chronologically,
yes,
then we can sort of make sure we hit all of your high points because you have a lot to tell us.
The savings and loan crisis was itself a crisis that where fundamental issues had existed since the creation of savings institutions back in the 1930s, and Freddie Mac was created during this period of time, and but what happened in the 1982 roughly to 1988 period, but throughout the 1980s was the institutions being unable to cope with the macroeconomic changes triggered by high rates of inflation and high rates of interest. The classic savings and loan had been restricted as to the assets that it could own, was focused around mortgages, was focused around fixed-rate mortgages. Indeed, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which used to be a block away from your location here, had seen fit in the 1980s to prohibit early on adjustable rate mortgages because for whatever infinite wisdom they possessed at the time, that was not what was politically popular. Fixed rate mortgages were politically popular, and so even as some institutions started to try and develop a more flexible instrument that would reduce interest rate risk, the political regulatory system didn't accommodate that. And so then when the Hurricane Katrina of that era struck in the form of inflation at double-digit rates and market levels of interest rate in the mid-teens, you had a pretty sudden and massive disintermediation of institutions who could offer 5.25% interest in an environment where money market funds were offering 16% when market rates were at that level, and so consumers obviously voted with their feet to pull deposits and move that, and that left institutions that had been holding underwater mortgages because the regulatory system relied on cost accounting, not market value, and so people were sitting holding portfolios of mortgages that might nominally be $1 billion, but might have actual market value of $400 or $500 million because they were 3% mortgages in a time when market rates are 12% or 14%. And the government basically was unable and unwilling to recognize the fact that the economic facts that had already happened, that these institutions going into this crisis were unprepared to deal with an environment of extremely high interest rates. They couldn't change. It's like having leases in a mall that last 20 years, as one of my portfolio companies today does. You know, if the economy changes, you know, your leases go out many, many years, and it takes time to migrate. Savings and loans had the same problem. They were sitting there with existing portfolios that were predicated on stability in interest rates. When that stability disappeared, they were then left, what do you do? Because to sell those mortgages would require crystallizing the losses, and none of them had enough, most of them did not have enough capital to absorb that. So they were in economic fact insolvent, but their doors were open every day, courtesy of Federal Deposit Insurance, which would keep the customers there. And so anyway, there were many elements of that that to me are similar parallels to the fundamental expectation in underlying the mortgage market and the global banking system in the 2000 era, that housing prices would never go down everywhere at once. I mean, people accepted the idea that individual markets might have housing price declines, but the idea that we might have artificially driven so much funding into mortgages and so many people might have purchased homes beyond their ability to carry that instrument, that when anything happened to interfere with that, that prices could come down significantly across the board, and portfolios just didn't have the capital backing to support that. So
was there something in Faria then that contributed to the events of the 2000s, or did Faria address?
Oh no, I think I believe we learned the lessons and put in place some good safeguards. Unfortunately, they were disregarded by later regulators
What were some examples?
Well, for example, the things that supervisors, and I will distinguish between regulations, i.e. notice and comment, you adopt a regulation, you put it in the Code of Federal Regulations, and things that the Federal Reserve does, which are supervisory actions pursuant to law, but not regulations themselves. So oftentimes the problems come in weak supervision. It isn't that supervisors don't have the laws that they need most of the time to do whatever they need to do. It's that they don't have enough backbone or foresight or courage or political independence or a variety of factors, but to do what they need to do. So the supervisory decisions in the savings and loan crisis had, as well as certain legislative decisions, had compounded the problem at every turn. You started out with something that was the front half of a horse stitched to the back half of a cow. I mean, you had asset powers to go out, particularly post-1982 when the Garn St. Germain Act said savings and loans can now invest in anything they want. They can fund commercial construction projects. They got way beyond mortgages. But they still had the traditional reliance on deposits and then brokered deposits. Anyway, you had this problem of the fundamental lack of solvency and lack. In their case, it wasn't just lack of capital, it was lack of solvency. And regulators then tried to cover that up. So, for example, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board initially cut the nominal capital requirements so that the leverage got down to 3% of assets, so you could have a 33-to-1 leverage ratio. Then they had historically, like the bank regulators, said that you could compute those capital ratios using the historic cost of assets rather than their market value. So if you had a portfolio of mortgages with unrealized losses, you could carry it as if, it's hear no evil, speak no evil. The little man on the stair wasn't there again today. As long as I don't touch it, I can carry these mortgages. Well, that means that your operating costs will often exceed your income, and eventually you'll use up your capital just through operating losses, not write-downs of your portfolio. So that put a lot of pressure on institutions to get higher rate performing assets, and they put a lot of pressure on their regulators to allow this to happen. So the bank board eventually said, passed a regulation in the form of what they called at the time regulatory accounting principles, or RAP instead of GAAP. And the Home Loan Bank Board's RAP was amended to say that you could sell mortgages at a loss and take the loss you experienced and count that as an asset. So I paid $1 billion for an asset. I sold it for $300 million. I lost $700 million. But the regulation said I could take my $700 million loss and I could put that on the books as an asset, a deferred loss. And then I was allowed to amortize that loss over the remaining life of the mortgages. So if they had 27 years to go, I could, for 27 years, be amortizing that. But in the meantime, I was allowed to lever at 33-to-1 my accumulated losses. So you had people out raising insured deposits backed by the taxpayers, backed by nothing but losses. So fairly extreme accounting, to say the least. And FIREA tried to, first we thought there should be accountability for the regulatory bodies, so we actually abolished the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and created the Office of Thrift Supervision, which employed most of the same people. The agency went from being an independent agency with three board members to being a part of the Treasury, parallel to the Comptroller of the Currency.
So how did you react when it was back where you started, the OTS?
How did I react?
Well, when you looked at the current events, and again, it was...
Well, but it's not really being true. I think the bad actor here, and I hate to use those words, the most disappointing agency that could have solved these problems and could have mitigated them was the Federal Reserve, not the OTS. The OTS is, by now, has very few regulatees and really is the caboose on the end of the regulatory train. And so it's the folks at the Federal Reserve that really drive the system. Anyway, we changed the agency, we abolished by statute that they couldn't use regulatory accounting principles, and I think we tried to push through the principle that there had to be in both FIREA and some later legislation that happened over the ensuing years, because there were a series of bills flowing out of this, that institutions had to be properly capitalized with meaningful levels of real economic capital in front of the taxpayers, and that supervisors were required. We tried to limit the discretion of supervisors not to act. And so there was a concept put in some of the legislation called prompt corrective action, where there were triggers of things that were supposed to force the hand of regulators to say, you can't leave zombie institutions out there competing every day with the healthy ones, because if federal policy says we will prop up the failed institutions, the ones you are damaging are the healthy ones.
Mm-hmm. That was Fiducia.
And that was Fiducia, which followed on
FIREA.
Forgive me for the alphabet soup.
So can you fast forward to current times and how these were neglected by current...
Well, if you look at several examples, I mean, the special purpose vehicles that were utilized by, not just in the United States, but around the world. Citicorp, I think, had 400 billion of them. Barclays had a lot and so on. These were glaring examples of the failure of supervisors to do their job. None of them should have existed at all. They were simply vehicles for speculation in high-risk assets to drive up bank management bonuses. That's all they were. Why would a major institution create a juridical entity? It's not a real company. It's just a paper construct. I'm going to go buy a portfolio of $1 billion of structured derivative products. I'm going to put it in that portfolio. And they have a tail, a life of multiple years. I'm going to fund it with essentially overnight funding, because I can get funding through the central bank at low rates, so I'll make this nice arbitrage. I'll buy all these expensive piece of paper, and I will fund it with short-term, essentially central bank funding, and the profits go into our bonus pool. No customer is asking for that. There are no clients involved. This is just institutions speculating without any correlation to why does the bank exist, why does it have a central bank behind it, why does it have a discount window, why does the public support it. There is no business being done. There are no homeowners being served. There's no small business. Just a naked exercise in speculation. And the idea that, well, if Citicorp's SPVs were to become insolvent, that Citicorp could actually just walk away from it and say, well, we were only kidding.
Why did they do that?
Well, because that is what Bear Stearns tried to do. And history shows what happened to Bear Stearns. I mean, if a financial institution has put its name in the money markets on something and it allows it to collapse, that would cause people to believe that they are unable to, that they are constrained in their capital availability to handle the obligations they've incurred, and you really wouldn't want to have debts from such a company. So the practical, it would be extremely difficult to imagine major institutions, the largest global banks, just defaulting willy-nilly in the markets on entities they've created. That they all rely on wholesale funding in the markets and to some degree or another. And now, BBVA is an example. The board I happen to serve on, it was interesting to me. We would have a board meeting once a month, and I'd say at least every other month for 5 years, the management and other board members would ask me what was going on with the housing bubble in the United States, and was the Federal Reserve ever going to constrain it, and what was going to happen, and how was the American government going to deal with it. And
what time period was that?
2002 to 2009.
So prior to the U.S. crisis, you had your folks overseas asking.
Yeah.
Was the Fed?
Everybody in the whole world knew that the mortgage bubble was there. I mean, it wasn't hidden. That's when I say you cannot look at any of this and say that the regulators did their job. But this was not some hidden problem. It wasn't out on Mars or Pluto or somewhere. It was right here. It was under. You cannot make trillions of dollars worth of mortgages and not have people notice. And so as an example, I was being asked regularly about it for years prior to the actual, end of the music. And they, as an institution, looked at it, and of course all the investment bankers came and tried to sell them on creating these structures just like they sold everybody else, and they wouldn't have anything to do with it. They said, well, what purpose would that serve?
So why weren't rate?
What sort of, do you remember roughly when those discussions started? What about this bubble in the U.S.?
I think initially it probably wasn't phrased as bubble, but the housing market and it's the price inflation and the risk of what happens if you had a price correction of a significant magnitude.
Why was it coming?
I would say probably 04 or 05, maybe.
Why was it coming to the attention of your bank? I mean, how was it being?
Well, because it was
investment decisions. I just want to put it in perspective.
Well, because of the concern that we would evaluate the bank's economists would. First of all, BBVA is not a household name here, but it is I can't recall, but it operates probably in 65 countries. It is one of the 20 largest banks, and it's a major global institution. And it also now, today, has probably $65 or $75 billion worth of assets in the U.S., owns a number of banks in the Southwest, owns the largest bank in Mexico, operates all over Latin America, Europe, China. So when they would look at and present to the board risk analyses of things that could impact the bank and its capital, we looked at the U.S. housing crisis for several years was one of the top three risks that they used to look at. Oil shocks was another. Various types of potential armed conflicts.
So sticking with that, your Spanish colleagues ask you this, and you have this thought in your mind that they have this provision called the prompt corrective action provision that they ought to be executing, and they're not doing it. I mean, can you tell us, sort of the chronology of you saying, what the heck, when am I going to see this kind of action on the part of the Fed?
I don't think it would serve. We don't have days. So legally, I don't think the conditions of prompt corrective action had been triggered because while the mortgage market was happy and housing prices were where they were, people hadn't incurred losses. Their capital hadn't become impaired. There just were massive risks.
Well, which is what they say. They say there weren't losses, so we couldn't act.
I'm
not sure. Yeah, well, that's a humorous argument. I hope you had a good chuckle when they said that.
So what's your response? I mean, you're the one who's been in those kinds of driver's seats.
Well, first of all, the regulators are right. You're not God. You're not king. You can't act arbitrarily and capriciously. You do have to act within the laws. But I find it hard to believe that the Federal Reserve, which over the years has put in place special scrutiny of LBO loans, for example, or special scrutiny of different kinds of risks, it has many, many ways of sending, as does the Comptroller of the Currency or the FDIC, of sending messages to the banking system of things where they want them to slow down and they want them to be more careful. And the mortgage arena was not one in which that was happening. And I think there was, at the top, Greenspan has said many times publicly, so he was a believer that the risk monitoring was best done by the institutions and not by the government. And he had a philosophy of abstinence from heavy-handed regulation, and I think that is in many circumstances, in most circumstances, that's an admirable characteristic. It just happened that over a prolonged period of very low interest rates, you've had huge volumes of money causing significant home price inflation. And appreciation is the better word for it, but or a more polite word for it, but you had house prices going up, and at some point you would have liked to have thought that the supervisors, for example, could have said, there is no purpose for these special purpose vehicles, you can't have them, period. That would have limited the, both sent a message and limited speculation. They could have, certainly later on in the process, they could have done things like denying when they wanted to buy Countrywide, when B of A said, well, we'll buy Countrywide, and if there's issues of B of A's capitalization, why are they allowed to buy anybody?
So why didn't they?
The whole case involving Merrill Lynch shouldn't have happened because B of A should have been out of the acquisition business long before that.
So why didn't they? Why didn't they act?
I wasn't there.
Well, I just seems to me, and maybe you can help me resolve this, something of a contradiction if one sets up regulations to operate to guard against things that are going wrong. If they're not set up, if a situation ensues where the regulations don't operate, then is it, you know, when we know how people behave, isn't it arguable that regulation should be stronger?
Well, that's what we tried to do in FIREA and FIDICIA. We tried to make the statutes stronger, and we tried to require action at certain times. And you have a tension, and a necessary tension, in any regulatory system of this kind, between statutory limits and discretion. And discretion sounds like a great thing, and it is important. Supervisors need to have some flexibility in looking at an institution and saying, yes, we think this is a temporary problem and we're not going to just run out and shut you down tomorrow, versus everything is we don't need any humans, the laws are so precise. Well, the laws can't cover everything in advance. You have a dynamic market, so you need some level of discretion on the part of supervisors. On the other hand, in the savings and loan crisis, we were harmed because the way in which discretion was operated, was exercised, was routinely influenced by the regulatees. The U.S. League of Savings Institutions was the lobbying group at the time, and they were one of the most powerful in Washington to come in, and you know, and so any regulations they didn't like, they would fiercely lobby against them, as happens in the banking sector, as happens across Washington. So supervisors who are the heads of the agencies, like the FDIC, I wouldn't call them exactly politicians, but they are political appointees.
Right.
They do work for elected officials. And so excessive discretion has caused problems before, and it, in my opinion, big time caused us problems in the run-up to this crisis, because supervisors had every legal authority to act, and they didn't use it.
But just
to be clear, I'm being fair, I'm jumping out of your chronological order here, but the SEC is not immune from that either. In 2004, Wall Street went to them and asked for a doubling of the leverage, permitted leverage under SEC capital rules, and to 33-1, which, by the way, I remember that number from somewhere. That's the same number the SNLs had. And instead of laughing them out of the room, the SEC, unfortunately, it's not one of history's greatest moments of the SEC, gave in.
Yeah,
and as a result, you know, when we hit the ultimate crisis, and you see every single one of the major broker-dealers becoming insolvent, they obviously had capital that had been cut to too low a level. People asked us to cut our capital rules. Actually, the pressure was from the Europeans during my time, and we wouldn't do it. And you know, you have to be willing to be a very unpopular person and not get invited to go to as many meetings or serve on as many boards after you leave government or get as many job offers. Being a tough supervisor is not, and remember that I don't want to, people try to do the best they can with limited information. No supervisor, none of the examiners, none of the decision makers above them have crystal balls. And if Citicorp or Goldman Sachs or Bank of America tells you, oh, this is our view of where the market's going to go over the next 2 years, you may think it sounds optimistic, but you can't disprove it either. Well, and it is true that most people at most of these agencies do hope to work at Goldman Sachs at some point in their career.
Okay, but
or Bank of America or Citicorp. And so, you know, there are limits to how much people will antagonize unless they have a specific legal mandate that they just can't go somewhere. But there is a tendency to want to try and be flexible and use your flexibility to accommodate what appear to be the reasonable competitive interests and requests of the regulated firms.
But is this a problem of imperfect information? Or is this a problem of the person who had the job that you once had, in the case of the chairman of the SEC, or the person who was at the head of the Federal Reserve? This is a problem of them having imperfect information, or of them being maybe either philosophically or somehow otherwise different from that category of people that served, you know, Bush one. You know, is this advisors serving the son of your boss differently or more poorly than you serving your boss?
I wouldn't phrase it that way. No, I mean we were closer to a crisis. I mean taxpayers lost initially a lot of money. We got some of it back in the savings and loan crisis. It was the fruits of the Hunt Commission, which was a commission created by President Nixon in 1972, wrote a report and said the greatest single risk facing the American financial system was the savings and loan system, the fundamental instability of the savings and loan system. That was 1972. The thing blew up in the late 80s, and you could find in the 60s and 50s other reports. So, you know, there had been a long period of time in which a problem had been allowed to grow. No political leaders in either the Congress or the White House had the foresight or courage or thought it was worth the capital, the political capital that would be necessary to fundamentally change the rule. And it wasn't killing anyone. These people were out competing. They were, you know, in every community. And so it was just something that while experts would look at it and say, you have a mismatch here between assets and liabilities such that you have interest rate risks that you cannot control and you're vulnerable financially to a meltdown. That meltdown had never occurred. We had never seen 16% interest rates in American money markets. We had never seen 12% inflation. And so people didn't go change the system because hypothetically you could have 12% inflation. It wasn't until Jimmy Carter actually produced 12% inflation that all of a sudden a theoretical financial exposure became very real losses in the marketplace. Now, when we acted, we had been seared by that experience. I mean, we'd seen the losses that could result, and I know when people came to me as SEC chairman in 90 and 91 and 92, really throughout my tenure there, there was a huge push by the bank regulators to get us to sign up for Basel II. And because they thought it would be wonderful to have both banking and the securities regulators agreeing to the same dumb rule. And the argument was, and it was truly to me, a fascinating example. I sometimes thought I was living in Alice in Wonderland. I mean, here I was, the head of a American regulatory supervisory body. Our country was only 2 years removed from having had the near collapse of a set of depository institutions with over $1 trillion of deposits. When I first started trying to solve that problem on January 20th of 1989, there were just a little over $3 billion left in the FSLIC. There were savings loans were losing $35 billion a month in withdrawals. There were hundreds of insolvent institutions. So we had been right at the edge of 1933, banking holiday, and we came away from it. And 2 years later, I'm sitting in Geneva in this meeting with a bunch of bank regulators and the related staff that support the Basel Committee, and they're trying to persuade me that we should sign up to a rule that involved was for the first time going to deal with market risk, as Basel I dealt with credit risk. And it had had many unrealistic features, such as if you made a loan to a business, you had to have 8% capital. That was deemed to have 100% risk weighting, and 8% was the standard. But if you bought a government bond, that was deemed to have zero risk. So you could have a $1 trillion leverage as long as you put all the money into government bonds, and because they had a zero risk weight, even though there's nothing on earth that is zero risk. And it was any kind of government bond. I remember asking someone in our negotiations, just to be playful, was I correct that that rule meant that if you bought bonds of the Central Bank of Zimbabwe, that they were also zero risk? And I was told yes. And the person, when I looked at them, said, well, okay, well, we all understand that lots of sovereign debt has many risks, and many countries are highly risky, but politically, we couldn't win agreement on a global standard if we said some countries are riskier than others. So we agreed to treat every country as being zero risk. I said, great, well, I don't want to sign up for a rule like that, because that isn't, it may be a political compromise that you needed to make if you had to have a global standard, but it isn't economic reality. Then the Basel II was a rule that was to have, in its draft at the time, was to have netting provisions, and they were very aggressive, with no minimum capital underlying the netting. So if an institution was long airline stocks and short railroad stocks, under the looseness of their definition of netting, that position would be deemed to fully offset and require no capital at all. And the SEC rules are much tougher than that, were much tougher than that, and capital would be required, because it is in fact possible for airline stocks to fall without railroad stocks rising. And so we thought the rule was conceptually had features that were good, but it wasn't there yet. It wasn't ready. And we came under a lot of pressure of people saying, we know it's not perfect. We know it. And we had back-tested the rule against the events of 1987 and had discovered that had the rule that we were being urged to apply been in place instead of the SEC's current rule, that most of the major broker-dealers would have collapsed.
Do you think the Fed got it right with the market risk amendment?
So, anyway, just to finish a long story, so I just said, no, it's not ready. It's not, you've got too many holes in it. It's a bad rule. And they said, well, you should sign up for it. And we all know it's a bad rule, but we'll fix it. I said, yeah, but the fix may take 5 years, and meanwhile, people will start building, engineering their portfolios the next day. And there was a huge level, which continues to this day, in the Basel process. There are lots of people who, at central banks around the world, are their full-time job is these capital process, and they're good, well-meaning people, and many of them exceptionally smart. But they have a very high level of dedication to trying to accomplish certain things, and when you're trying to have global regulatory standards, it's much worse than trying to do it on a domestic level, because now you have to get agreement from hundreds of countries to make any improvements, and if you make a mistake, fixing things It's a very inflexible, slow-moving glacial system. So I was, for years, treated as I was, in those circles, treated as if I was a bad international citizen and I didn't believe in common global rules. And I kept saying, well, you know, I believe in common global rules if you can come up with good ones. But in the meantime, if we have a better one, the president didn't send me over to the SEC to cut the SEC capital rules by, in effect, 90%, which was what our economists and regulatory guys said that rule would have done. And I said, you can call me what you want, but until you get a better product, we're going to stick with what we have, because if you want to skate on thin ice in other institutions and other countries, go right ahead. But my job is to try and prevent failures from happening that we can't control, and I don't think this rule is adequate. And until we see a rule that we think is adequate, we're not going to sign up.
What did President Bush think?
He didn't think anything at all about that rule. I mean, no president is going to read the formula for how a capital rule works.
No. I mean, generally speaking, the attitude you had that made you seem like an outsider.
Well, I was an insider in our system. It was just I was not a bank regulator. This was the first time the bank regulators had come to the securities regulators and said, we'd like you to get rid of the rules you've spent 80 years refining and adopt our rules that we finished last night. And so the SEC has earned a reputation for independence since 1934, and I think I probably reinforced that impression. But I don't think, if you'd had something that had been presented at a cabinet meeting, I mean, and there have been lots of issues, but the Basel rules, let's face it, in this crisis, failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And arguably, aside from regulators not being tough enough, the single most important reason why this crisis happened was the failure of the Basel capital rules. They didn't require enough, and they didn't measure risk realistically. Didn't require enough capital, and they didn't measure risk realistically. And so every one of those institutions that failed didn't have enough capital. So I'm not impugning the effort or integrity of the people who wrote the rules. They just didn't work. I seem to remember reading somewhere, and I wish I could remember where, because it was a fascinating statistic, but maybe you guys have come across it in your research, but that banks in 1900 had roughly four times the tangible capital as a percent of assets as banks today. And of course, that's before deposit insurance and discount windows and all these other things. But when we talk about the modern financial, we have relentlessly pushed to find ways to have major institutions on which hundreds of thousands of people or millions depend have less and less capital protecting them against losses. And, that simply went too far, and people weren't cautious enough. I do remember at BBVA we had this one absolutely stunning presentation from our chief economist, who took and ranked the 25 largest banks in Europe and ranked them from top to bottom based on Tier 1 capital ratio, strongest to weakest, and then took a very simple measure, tangible capital to total assets, and rank the same 25 banks top to bottom, highest to lowest. Well, when you looked at the banks, the lists were exactly the inverse. The people who had the highest Tier 1 Basel capital ratios had the lowest tangible capital to assets. People who had the highest tangible capital to total assets, real economic capital, in my definition, tended to have the lowest Tier 1. And what that said loud and clear, and the failures had been concentrated most heavily among the people with the highest Tier 1 capital ratios. So the entire process of bureaucracies setting up rules that will measure market risk and then allowing capital credits where you can take extra risk if it's a bureaucratically favored category of asset, had unleashed armies of people engineering balance sheets so that you could take higher risks than the rule thought you were taking. And thereby achieve higher practical leverage, which of course magnifies returns when you're generating returns. And so a lot of our sophistication has given us tools to move us away, give us false confidence that we really can predict where the next risk is coming from, and allow leverage at levels that, when it's tested, and the problem with the global capital rule is if everybody in the world is on the same standard and that standard proves out to be wrong, then the whole world has got a problem. And that is exactly what happened here. So my little vignette of history of as that process was going on was that the pressures among the people writing the rule were all, we need to be able to show the world that we could get together and agree and we took action. And that's more important than that we got it right. Because if we didn't get it right, we'll fix it over time. But I think we have been, versus I tend to believe that the regulation is more appropriately focused on the specific risks you're trying to control. And if regulations in the United States are slightly different than regulations in Hong Kong, that is not the biggest problem in my book. More important that regulations in both America and Hong Kong work, even if they happen to be different regulations. But there was a huge push, and has been for 20 years, of sort of let's make things simple and convenient for Citigroup or Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank or anybody that operates in every country. If we have consistent rules, then they won't have to, you know, figure out all the different standards in all the different countries. And that does create vulnerability if those standards are achieved through consensus-building processes that end up being too weak.
What's so the solution there? Is you end up responding as a regulator or supervisor to what appears to be pressure to make the system more effective for these multinational banks, when in fact what they may be doing is you know, enjoying the lack of clarity, right? And having right. capital move to the most attractive sort of regulatory niche.
I don't think anybody has a, you know, these are things that are in tension. They are forces that there is no right answer. There is no perfect balance that will be immutable for all time. You have to balance off reasonable consistency, at least in principles, of how rules work in a global economy against if there are emerging dangers, it's better to have, and this is a personal opinion, but instead of having one agency in charge of systemic risk for the whole country or the world, I'd rather have 10 agencies, because the head of any one agency can be wrong more easily than 10 different people can be wrong. And human beings bring their judgment to these questions, and I think when you try and centralize everything and have everything the same, you run the risk that you run significant risks of myopia or of bad judgment or of a single person's bad decision having a greater effect than it has to have if you had a little more resilience in the system by having multiple decision makers. So, for example, I would never, if there were still broker-dealers, I mean, I would have said it was always, I think the system served us well that we had multiple regulatory agencies. You can question, you know, should you have the FDIC, the Comptroller, and the Federal Reserve, but it actually means that if Sheila Bair disagrees with Alan Greenspan, that's a healthy thing. Mm-hmm. Congress and the public get to hear that's a dispute. There's a difference of opinion. They can look at it, and other people can then make their point of view. If you centralize everything under one body, as Japan historically did in the Ministry of Finance, then all those genuine debates about risk and policy are internalized within the bureaucracy, and the public never sees it.
Yes, the securities industry in this country, that's how it's been. It's been centralized in one regulator rather than diffused the way the banking regulators have done. So what went wrong with the investment banks that the large ones didn't make it through this financial crisis?
They didn't have enough capital. They were taking too big of risks. I mean, you know, and of course they were they had large exposure to the same risk of a nationwide decline in the housing crisis that the banks did. But and they proved inadequately capitalized, as did the banks.
Right.
And,
so you were critical of banks having SIVs or SPVs. Why, in your opinion, would the SEC allow the investment banks to invest in these securities or to resell these securities if there's something inherently wrong with them?
Well, historically, the SEC doesn't operate like a bank regulator and has never seen securities firms as being supported by a federal safety net. And if they want to go bankrupt, they should go ahead. That was the philosophy. The a brokerage customer, the public, dealing with Merrill Lynch or Payne Webber or any of the traditional brokerages, if you have securities and they're not on margin credit, your 401k is held at whatever institution and you have these securities, those are segregated for you. The firm can't hypothecate those for its own borrowings. So when Drexel failed, for example, we took all the customer accounts, we moved them overnight to Payne Webber, and got the public out of the way. Now, the question of whether, as a corporate entity, Drexel Burnham failed is separate from what happens to those account holders, because all of their holdings are segregated and they move over to somebody else. So the philosophy underlying the broker-dealer system always was that institutions could invest in anything they want. You don't have the same types of support or protections that exist in the banking system. And quite critically, the thing that always made it work was everything was marked to market every day. So these portfolios that are held on the books at levels vastly above their worth, that never existed in the SEC, because at 4 o'clock each and every day, every instrument gets marked to market. And if you run out of capital that night, you're closed. And that is a radically different system than in the banking world, where instruments, by and large, are held at cost. And
but if for all this to work, for investor protection to work, the disclosures have to be adequate and the disclosures have to be accurate, correct?
You're mixing apples and oranges.
Okay, explain that to me.
Well, which investors are you talking about in disclosures about which instruments?
In terms of...
I was talking about my mother has a brokerage account with UBS. She owns AT&T common stock. That common stock, there's no disclosure issue there. She owns it. It is hers. UBS cannot pledge those securities against borrowings to create an SPV. Those belong to her. They cannot do anything with it. If UBS goes bankrupt tomorrow, those securities get picked up and transferred, put in a truck and driven. Actually, they're in DTC. They're electronically. You flip the switch, and they now are at your account in wherever you chose to move it. So the customer had no risk at all to the failure of the institution, so long as they weren't margining. Now, if they're margining those securities, then that is not the case. But so I'm not sure in your example question where the disclosure problem is.
Going back to the original sale of the securities, that if you were critical of certain institutions selling into the marketplace certain investments, so if the investments are being fully disclosed, what's wrong with that? If the disclosures are accurate, why not have a completely free market?
I totally believe that.
Okay.
I didn't suggest that.
You mentioned Drexel.
So the issue, I think, I'm not sure, I don't exactly understand where I'm missing you, but if it is a question of Goldman Sachs or Bear Stearns selling their own stock, and the quality of their 10-K is describing their own portfolio so that investors in their debt or equity, do they correctly understand the portfolio? That's a different question.
But if there was something wrong with these securities,
are you talking about 144A?
I think in a minute we're going to move to sophisticated investors as opposed to customer accounts.
Sorry for getting bogged down.
But we want to move to several things, including Drexel. But can I just tie a bow around the Basel rules?
I
heard you to say, but I don't want to misinterpret you in any way, that you believe the single biggest cause of this financial crisis was both the SEC's adoption of the alternative net capital rule, which was in some ways Basel II-like, and the Fed's adoption of the market risk rule. Is that, and their portions of Basel II. I mean, nobody adopted Basel II outright, but both did adopt portions of Basel II, and I heard you to say that those rule shifts and the application of those shifts, and which could be, you know, and what I wanted to understand was whether it was the outright adoption of the rule or the effect of the rule. So was it the fact that we went market to model, or was it the fact that our models were wrong, or was it the fact that the rating agencies were written into our application of the models?
I think a lot of those factors were in place. What I was trying to identify as the largest single problem, as best I can see, is inadequate capitalization in the financial institutions. And then there are a lot of reasons why they prove to be inadequately capitalized. And inadequately capitalized when, it's just like in the 1980s, what we had never seen before was double-digit inflation and mid-teens interest rates. And so you had institutions who had portfolios that were constructed assuming a certain tolerance and a certain boundaries to bad things that could happen in the marketplace. And when things happened that were three or four times worse than those assumed boundaries, the system didn't have the economic backing to stand up to risks that proved beyond models or expectations. I think the same thing happened again in the more recent crisis, that we designed rules with expectations and assumptions built in them, and rules are only as good as the assumptions you use in making them. I was used to when people would tell me that we shouldn't push them on their risk controls because they had this wonderful model and it was accurate to two standard deviations. I said, well, great, that two standard deviations means the Titanic sinks every 40 years. And, you know, if I'm in charge of the lives of the people on the boat, then sinking every 40 years is not okay with me. And so, but, you know, it is a question of assumptions. So we had an extraordinary economic event that trillions of dollars of home prices deflated relatively suddenly by a magnitude across the board, not just in Kansas City or Minneapolis or New York, but everywhere, in a very compressed period of time. And that expectation was not built into the worst things that people could imagine happen. And so part of it was the macroeconomic fact, the meteor that hit us of the aggregate value of American homes, and you guys from your research would know, you know, if it's $15 trillion and it goes to $10 trillion, that's $5 trillion of losses, and you better have $5 trillion of capital because those are real losses. And we didn't. And part of that then was, but I wouldn't call Basel, and neither the SEC's adoption, change of their capital, did not bring on this crisis, and nor did Basel itself. I think you'd have to look at why did home prices appreciate above the rental value of homes and above people's ability to carry loans. Why were, you know, you had millions of people, I don't need to tell you guys, but you had millions of people who were buying homes they couldn't afford, saying, well, it's no problem, I can always sell. And, well, But, of course, a supervisor should know that, well, you might not always be able to sell it. You have certainly not only price declines, you have periods of illiquidity when market freezes up. And so what are all those people going to do if they need to sell and they can't? And so the meteor that struck was the housing price decline reflecting a bubble in that asset. And that was driven not by the capital rule, but that was driven by monetary policy and the flow of availability of funds. And now, if you're going to have a, and I do not hold myself out as a monetary policy expert, but I should think that if you wanted to have a long period of time with extremely accommodative monetary policy and provide flooding the system with cash, then while it's very difficult, I think, to see, to know for sure that you're seeing a bubble when you're seeing it, you know, you have to be on high alert for those kind of things. So I would say the macroeconomic forces were what the major cause. In pure supervisory system, the regulatory system failed because we didn't have, institutions didn't have enough capital. And that, in turn, was in part because the Basel rules didn't work. And it's not, no, I'm not saying, and please don't, I mean, I hope the tape recorders, when the archaeologists are listening to this,
that's why I asked the question,
you know, years later, are not, I'm not saying that the people who wrote those rules caused the crisis. I'm just saying that that the system was more vulnerable because everybody in the world was operating on the same set of rules with the same set of assumptions, and they proved inadequate.
Staying on Donna's question here for a second, we heard from a member of the Fed Board of Governors that until this particular person left the Fed in 07, the Fed did not have, and also claimed that banks did not have, models to properly assess operational risk. And I wonder whether that's interesting or surprising to you, and whether you think that in that kind of a situation there's room for supervisory or regulatory action that would prevent banks from going out on a limb and inventing, for example, devices to hedge against capital requirements, whatever else, before they get the modeling right. Because we've heard plenty of times that they didn't have the models right in the private sector. Now it turns out, you know, the Fed didn't even have models that could adequately address this.
I hope you weren't surprised.
That's the second time you've responded to me like that, that I should have laughed. I mean,
well, no, I mean, governments
don't. I'm supposed to sleep at night thinking someone's supposed to think of these things.
They're human beings. They're bureaucracies. They don't have, they're not philosopher kings. They don't. When I was chairman of the SEC, okay, I had great, I was sitting at the top of America's $5 trillion at the time, capital markets. I couldn't tell you where every risk that might hit the system was going to come from. I could work 24 hours a day. I did work nearly 24 hours a day, as I remember. But, you know, I'm just a human being. You do your best. You have great staff. And the Fed and the SEC both have historically had great staffs, and they work hard, and they have lots of accumulated experience in their DNA. And they try and make good, sensible decisions, but you're not perfect. And so the rules have to be constructed around the presumption that, guess what, our models will prove faulty. And part of, I think, the whole, since the Basel process and all this Tier 1, and that was why my story, that the what they did in 1900, tangible capital, you don't get to count goodwill, tangible capital, and that was part of FIREA. We said you've got to have a tangible capital requirement, not just overall capital, because if it's accumulated losses, it really doesn't help very much. So tangible capital to total assets, very crude. Before the invention of any of the Nobel Prizes for economics, before anybody invented derivatives, before anybody invented all this fancy stuff, you just, if you were going to have $100 worth of risk, you needed to have $10 or $15 or $20 worth of capital. Now we have got the principle that officially, now we're changing, of course, but I mean, when this problem happened, that $8 of capital against $100 of assets was enough, except it was oversold, because it wasn't really $8 of capital against $100 worth of assets. It was $100 of bureaucratically defined assets. And there were loopholes in the rules so that if you paid somebody enough and got somebody smart enough, they could find a way to have $1 billion qualify of assets qualify as $100 of risk-weighted assets. And so you really had effective capital leverage in some institutions that was $8 against $1 billion, not $8 against $100. And so in the name of sophisticated risk management, companies in the private sector and regulators have built more and more elaborate methodological processes for measuring risk and then deciding how much capital you need in order to understand your value at risk and your capital requirements, and that you should, in theory, never be able to fail. Look at all these institutions that failed for the simple reason that models always fail. Assumption models are built on assumptions, and they will never imagine the thing that gets you will not be the thing you were worried about. And I think it's, in some sense, it's a lack of humility on the part, and a lack of common sense on the parts of particularly boards of directors, a subject I don't want to miss in all of this. Mm-hmm. So what that some consultant who you pay to tell you that you should not worry says, oh boy, just pay me enough and I can give you a system that'll pile up risks but you'll still be safe. Well, why not don't take so many risks in the first place? What happens if that consultant just happens to be wrong? Then you're dead, and your shareholders are dead, and your depositors are dead. Maybe some level of... So I think in some respects, both institutions and their regulators have gotten too infatuated with, we can measure every risk in the world, and in fact, we're not quite so infallible. And so you need better buffers built in for what happens if the things that the model isn't built to expect happen.
So do you allow less innovation?
No, I think people can be as innovative as they want with their own money.
Okay.
But take hedge funds. Why didn't any hedge funds fail? I run an investment fund. I have, I hope, in the 2 hours I've been here, I still have some over $1 billion out in the marketplace. Every investment we make, my money goes alongside of it. And while hedge funds can certainly make a lot of money and can lose a lot of money, but you didn't see the problems of the commercial banking sector and the big broker-dealers in the hedge fund community, in part because people are investing their own money. And so if all you're doing is playing the shareholder money and depositors' money, and this is and not enough money of some identifiable investors' money, hopefully the management and investors, that is at risk, then you get to terrible problems. So I'm not against innovation, although I frankly don't know whether there are things that are touted as innovations. But I think the world would be perfectly fine if we'd never invented structured derivatives. So the fact that it's new doesn't make it good.
We want to cover a number of things, including derivatives, but Mike wants to get back
I've
to...
I've been trying to get in for a while.
Patience.
I'm sorry. I'm talking too much.
It's not you. There are two things that I wanted to get into that I think are very important and you have firsthand knowledge of. One is the Drexel failure, and the other is Rule 144A.
Yep.
Drexel...
Guilty and guilty.
Okay. I haven't laid any charges here. Drexel, I was curious if the Fed tried to influence decisions about their failure.
Yes.
And what sort of things did they say or do?
Well, the Fed was not of... unanimous, consistent point of view,
okay.
In the sense we, in the days leading up to Drexel's failure, and I'm talking now about the failure of the holding company,
right.
Not the original indictment and their original,
yeah.
Not the whole Mike Milken case and so on, but the actual collapse of the firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was a Friday afternoon, as I recall, and I had just landed in Denver, I think, for a few days of vacation with my family, and I got a call and was told that Morgan Stanley had stopped taking Drexel as a counterparty, and this was producing a run on Drexel, a serious situation. And I turned around and came back to Washington, and Drexel, when you looked at its balance sheet, was nominally highly capitalized. They had, as I recall at the time, one of the higher levels of, the SEC has a concept called excess net worth, which is you mark everything to market, you need not that much more than that, you have to have positive net worth, and then everything above a fairly small minimum buffer based on, it's a really a liquidation analysis. If we sold your book overnight, as long as you have a dollar left, that's okay. But it can never be below a dollar.
Right.
And then people would measure how much above that minimum they had it, and Drexel had a pretty healthy buffer. They began as this run took place, and all this, and we had the same thing in Salomon Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, when we brought in Warren Buffett to stabilize Salomon, when it had a run as a result of its scandals involving government bond markets. So I really had two of them, one that we saved and one that we didn't. So the broker-dealers all have very short-term liabilities. They tend to fund themselves with repos, and so of relatively short duration. So a broker-dealer like Drexel at the time, and I don't remember the exact number, but might have had 1,000 providers of liquidity in the world. And that liquidity might be 7 days, you know, but it rolls over fairly frequently, and as long as there's no lack of confidence, the system works fine. But they are vulnerable to what happens to a loss of confidence. So Morgan Stanley stops taking them as a counterparty in trading, which was taken loud and clear in market circles as they think Drexel is going to fail. As people wouldn't roll over their securities, Drexel starts upstreaming capital out of its broker-dealer to the holding company where these financing instruments were located. And we eventually stopped that, because that was preferring holding company creditors to and putting at risk the regulated
right.
customers in the regulated broker-dealer, and we felt the priority had to be to keep the capital in there.
And the Fed?
Oh, go ahead. So the Fed, when this happened and as it accelerated, Drexel began talking to some banks, and they had a portfolio at the holding company level that was filled with junk bond, stubs of junk bond issues. So whenever Drexel had for years during the Mike Milken era fought very hard to make sure that the other major, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Merrill, didn't establish credibility in the junk bond business. And one of the ways they did that was to make sure that when they distributed securities that they weren't selling them to those people because they could say they had experience with them. So whatever they couldn't lay off to other buyers when they were doing an underwriting of junk bonds, they would take themselves. And so they had a portfolio of billions of dollars of, you know, Hearts Mountain pick bonds and, you know, Sharon Steele pick bonds and very unusual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had quotes for them and that were reflected in Drexel's balance sheet, but the only quotes were from Drexel itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you believed their quotes, they had lots of capital. If you didn't, then they might not. And that was a function of there weren't other people quoting those instruments in the market. It was like other fixed income markets, it was lacking transparency, not like the equity market where, you know, you can get a very reliable quote. Anyway, so as this began to take place, they started negotiating with banks to lend against those securities that were illiquid. And I can remember getting a call saying, well, the banks aren't lending to us. We need you to, the government needs to tell them they have to lend to us.
This is from Drexel or from
this
the Fed?
This is from Drexel.
Okay.
To me. Head of the CEO of Drexel calling me and saying, you know, we're having a serious problem. The banks are not, don't seem to be willing to lend to us, and we're running out of liquidity. And there were discussions with myself, Nick Brady, who was Secretary of the Treasury, Alan Greenspan, Jerry Corrigan, who was then President of the New York Fed, and over whether or not to urge the banks, formally or informally, to lend to Drexel. It was my view that Drexel did not merit a bailout. Now, mind you, in the situation that you're studying was much more severe because you had all institutions simultaneously being under pressure. We were just dealing with a more or less a one-off. This wasn't
right. The
world wasn't melting down. Drexel was melting down.
Right.
And my view was that there's no federal implicit guarantee for investors in the debt instruments of the holding company of a broker-dealer. And if they couldn't fund themselves, they should file for Chapter 11. The Fed did, while I think Greenspan was kind of straddling the fence, the New York Fed was of the view that we should rescue them. And the rationale for that was that if we didn't, there really was no way of guaranteeing that a failure would not lead to instability in the markets.
And we
disagreed with that and said that markets understand there's no federal guarantee here. They're not expecting a federal guarantee. To deliver a federal guarantee, sort of like what happened at AIG, if you suddenly give everybody that has an unsecured swap contract with an unregulated subsidiary of AIG a treasury bill, that's a windfall. Mm-hmm. And that's a windfall they didn't pay for. So we were not going to turn the debt instruments of Drexel's holding company into taxpayer obligations. But the Fed did say, well, if we didn't do that, there was a risk that the market would experience instability. And I said, well, that's what all those people get paid for.
Right.
And, they'll jolly well sort it out.
In other situations, the Fed has pressured banks to do that. I can think of the Penn Central and then I think Dreyfus or the repo market in 82.
The Hunt Brothers,
thank you.
Long-term
why did
capital.
Your...
Don't stop. It's a very long list.
Right. Why did your view prevail at this time?
Because I was chairman of the SEC and we were their regulator.
Okay.
If we'd had one super regulatory body, then that person would have said, we're going to bail them out. And this was an example where the fact that you had multiple different agencies with different focuses and different sets of responsibilities and expectations could lead to different decisions. So I respected the Fed's opinion, but and the Treasury supported us. I mean, we were certainly, I can remember several nights in a row, many, many hours into the night, at being on the phone in discussions, although what I've read about the discussions in Lehman and Bear Stearns, they had a lot more people on the phone. It was really the four of us, Nick and Jerry and Alan and I, but you know, we took seriously. Well, do we think we can let this go down? And it was a benefit to my point of view that the Secretary of the Treasury had come out of the securities industry, and Secretary Brady was very strongly of the view that nobody in the brokerage industry is within the federal safety net, that they are all uninsured, and that if they want to go take the world's biggest risks, they better be prepared to take the world's biggest fall. And if we change that, we would radically change the system, and that was not something that Drexel should deliver to the world. They'd done enough damage. So he supported me in the view that we should be prepared to have them file for Chapter 11 and that would be perfectly fine. We moved the public customers, so they were out of the way. And I can remember one of the arguments that the New York Fed used was that that several central banks, I seem to recall Hungary and Portugal and China, and China was not the economic power that it is today, had lent some of their gold bullion at the New York Fed to Drexel. Drexel had been doing gold repos, so gold bars don't pay a dividend. And so in order to create a cash flow from their holdings of gold, some of these countries had actually given it to Drexel, where it was vulnerable to their credit. And I can remember them saying that, well, it might cause panic in the market if people found out that the Central Bank of Portugal had lost some of its gold holdings to Drexel. And I said I thought it'd be on the Comedy Channel, but I didn't think panic was the right, you know, maybe people would think it was funny that sophisticated central banks, you know, lent their gold to Drexel and didn't protect themselves, but I didn't think that would lead to a worldwide panic. And I turned out to be right. When they announced they were going to file for Chapter 11, the junk bond market rallied. The market was worried the risk that we would change the system, that we would do something unexpected. And that was a terrible problem in all of the deals that were being done. Bear Stearns and Fannie and Freddie and Lehman and Merrill, because each one was different. And I can remember sitting there at the time, wondering, okay, where one deal says you're at risk if you're in equities, but not if you're in preferreds. Fannie and Freddie said it's equity and preferreds, but you're okay if you're in debt. And so lots of people who had Lehman debt and Merrill debt looked at that and said, fine, we're okay. And then, then Lehman happens, and they said, okay, now the debt isn't safe either. And, of course, there had been, between Bear Stearns' original problems and the failure of Lehman, there had been lots and lots of time in which all the money market funds in the United States, for example, could have, in an orderly way, gotten out of Lehman paper or B of A paper if they got scared. But if you create the impression that the debt instruments are inside the safety net and then it turns out they're not, then that creates shock. And markets, in my experience, can cope with any amount of risk and any amount of bad news. What they don't cope well with is shock, unexpected bad news. If it's expected bad news, they can price it and markets can accommodate to it. So the manner in which the ad hoc decisions that were being made, and I can remember, and this is just one investor, I can remember sitting there, and every time we would do one of these things, and Secretary Paulson would come out and announced that, well, we had to take this action, we'd run out of time because Asian markets were going to open and we had to have decided what we were going to do before. I wanted to call him up. I didn't know the secretary and wanted to say, will you quit worrying about traders in the Tokyo Stock Exchange? Let them worry. Let them be in the dark. Who cares? Okay, so they have a bad day. So what? I mean, don't make a bad decision that sets a precedent for how the entire world, but certainly how the American market is going to be, because you're worried that they're about to start trading in Tokyo. Well, fine. They can go out to lunch. And, so we took some actions that I think are relevant to what Congress should do in the wake of it that I don't think Dodd-Frank addressed. I wanted to give one story because and I know we're running out of time, so forgive me, but the difference between FIREA and the AIG bailout, I think one of the most irresponsible actions that I saw take place was bailing out the swap counterparties of AIG at 100 cents on the dollar. And arguably, the credit default swap market is the largest Ponzi scheme in the world. There's no capital really backing the system. There isn't enough capital in the basic banking system to capitalize all the risks we take. There certainly isn't enough capital to then reinsure all those risks through the swap market. And in a way, it strikes me as similar to the corrosive effect of securitization, where people said, all right, we're underwriting loans that people might not be able to pay back, but I don't have to worry because I'm going to package them and sell them, and 30 days from now I won't own them anymore. And that's the problem of the poor Norwegian elementary school district that buys them. Not my problem. And so we logically said, well, fine, we're going to make you hold a piece of that risk so you have some reason to care about whether you shouldn't be making loans without reason to care whether they're repaid. Well, in the credit swaps market, if you believe that it's a real market and that it actually has enough capital to pay all those swap contracts, if something unexpected happened and you actually needed to pay them all, I lost my train of thought there. You can't expect that the system, it creates an incentive for people to say, well, I'm not going to worry about the original risk, and maybe this company can't pay this bond or other instrument, but that's all right, I'll just buy swap coverage. And I don't even need to read the prospectus because I can just watch the spread rate and CDSs, and if the CDS spread rate spikes on a particular company's bonds, then I'll sell it or I'll buy more. Well, that's a false sense of security because it might happen that the swap market, which is completely unregulated and free to have a billion-to-one leverage, nobody knows who's providing all these swap contracts, and nobody that, until we were to get to a system where everything was on an exchange with a clearinghouse and had transparency to know for sure, okay, who's the other side of all these contracts and can they make good on them? Or is this just giving you an excuse to feel like you can take this big position because you're protected by something which may or may not end up protecting you? But we had very great reliance. We have, I think, dangerous reliance on the accuracy of the credit swap market, which isn't a real market and isn't producing accurate economic signals, as far as I can tell. And but it induces people to take risk that might, false sense of security. I don't have to worry because I have swap protection, or I can always go buy it. And that to me is very dangerous. Now, had the government said, well, we'll cover AIG swap contracts up to 50 cents on the dollar, or 60, or 70, but pick some number, put some haircut of a loss, it would have been the single best thing that could have been done because it would have forced people to realize that there are risks in the swap market, and you can't just assume that those are treasury bills, that, yes, the United States taxpayers will step up and honor Deutsche Bank's swap contracts, and they're not being paid to do that. So we took an action there that was inconsistent with what we did at Drexel, where we said, we're not going to protect you. You have an unwritten if you have an expectation that the United States government will protect debt instruments of Drexel Burnham's Holding Company, guess what? That was a wrong expectation. We didn't promise it to you, and we're not going to do it. In AIG, people got a treasury bill when they had no right to expect it, and that created massive level, colossal, unmeasurable amounts of risk for the future.
Okay. And then I wanted to get in Rule 144A. Just putting it in context of the time that it was formulated rather than, what may have happened later. What was
Do you like Rule 144A?
There are some people who have issues not so much with 144A, but the abuse of 144A. One of our hearings, the Clayton, I don't know if you followed that. But anyway, that's sort of, I don't want that to influence the question because I want to put this in the context of when it was passed. So the question is, I guess, what was the impetus behind it? Why were you considering it? Who was behind it? That sort of thing. And what was it intended to govern?
The people behind it were Linda Quinn, who headed the corporate finance department and was one of the greatest civil servants and lawyers and people I've ever met, who died a few years ago, tragically.
I was thinking more in the sense of...
And me.
Was this something that the SEC had been considering for a long time, just observing the market, or did people come to the SEC and say, we've got this market, it's really inefficient, we ought to do something about this?
Probably a little bit of both. There have been private placements since 1930s, mm-hmm. And so there has always been Rule 144A's, Rule 144 securities,
right.
And there have always been Reg D securities and things that were being sold to an institutional purchaser and therefore did not require the same level of protection that we give to things being sold in public markets. I think that is a sensible way of government economy. The large institutions should not look to a GS-15 at the SEC to protect themselves. They should have a staff to do their own homework. What we were trying to do, and so over 70 years, there had been large volumes of privately placed securities. We saw no problems at all with the existence of private placements.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What we were trying to do was to say that if I can privately place an issuance of bonds or preferred stock to MetLife without full registration in, mm-hmm. as a public offering, and if I could also sell the same private placement to New York Life mm-hmm. or Prudential, why shouldn't MetLife be able to sell it to
right.
New York
exactly.
Life, as long as the buyer from them could have bought originally, met all the standards to have been the original buyer? I think that was the right thing to do, and I still think it's the right thing to do.
Right.
So we were trying to reduce... Issuers paid a premium in the cost of privately placed securities, drove up their cost of capital. It was a premium because MetLife, when it bought that instrument, couldn't sell it.
Right.
So they paid an illiquidity premium, and so Rule 144A reduced that premium on every issuer of privately placed debt in the American capital markets, which is to say every company in the world, potentially,
mm-hmm.
and that was a huge... we were trying to drive down the cost of capital for issuers.
Right.
In a circumstance in which we thought that there was an element of that cost of capital that was created by a regulatory penalty that did not need to exist. So if you had 100 qualified institutional purchasers that could buy a given security, we really didn't see why we shouldn't allow those 100 people to trade it back and forth,
right.
so long as it never went to anyone who couldn't have bought it in the first place.
Exactly. Okay. And in terms of the, maybe I should follow up with specific that there. I've heard some people say, "Oh, it was the unregulated markets in Europe were putting pressure on." The U.S. markets, and so therefore the SEC felt pressure to, not necessarily with 144A in particular, but in general to loosen requirements.
No, I to this day, I think that was a sensible change that benefited the economy.
I thought that I knew your answer before I asked it, but I thought I'd get it on
record.
Sorry for
being so predictable.
No problem. And again, to put it in context, what kind of securities were...
And by the way, had it been that kind of competitive pressure, and I before, one of the few good things that the whole this whole crisis did was to stop the train that had been, I mean, a year before he was bailing out AIG, Secretary Paulson was giving speeches about how our international competitiveness, we needed to get rid of all the securities laws and get rid
mm-hmm.
of investor protections because it might mean that Goldman Sachs did fewer underwritings in the New York market instead of London or somewhere else. And I think that there has been a 20-year-long erosion of the perceived importance of investor protections in the United States. And I really, what the economists sometimes like to call the nanny state, or
mm-hmm.
Likes to always accuse the SEC of being a governmental nanny, which is a fascinating image. But it's really not that. But but the concept that, and one of the big differences between the U.S. system, at least when I was chairman of the SEC, and my European counterparts, Europeans tended to be other countries that tended to write rules, lots of rules. Mm-hmm. They're very good at writing rules. Writing rules is fun. But they don't enforce them nearly to the extent that we do, and they just don't have the resources and capabilities. So our system is quite different because we actually, when we write a rule, we actually intend to enforce it. And that leads to quite a few differences. But the notion that if, and in every market, you know, you want to see competitiveness, but that is a buzzword that can get severely overused. If companies wish to deliberately omit to disclose material information about risks, or if they wish to deliberately lie about risks, then they should offer, in my view, their securities in some other country. And if the investors there lose their children's college savings money, then that's sad, but it's better than having that happen here. And so I think we have sometimes get carried away in our mercantile spirits of worrying about how many IPO. I mean, if in my experience, the cost of a foreign issuer complying with U.S. accounting and disclosure requirements, and when I went to Coopers and Lybrand, I had a unit that did that for a foreign company. I knew exactly what it cost. Mm-hmm. Would be, you know, on the order of a tenth of the underwriter's fee.
Right.
So if you're worried about not doing enough underwritings in New York, maybe cut your fees rather than saying we're going to cut the protections for retired school teachers who are buying these securities. But
one last question, I'll make it quick because I know other people want to get in. The securities offered for private placement back then were different to some. I mean, there are securities being offered now that weren't around then.
Correct.
If those had been around at that time, would that have changed your opinion at all about
yes,
the wisdom?
Yes, might have. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think we were dealing for the most part with an issue, what I would call, you know, corporate securities.
Mm-hmm.
People that were raising capital with bonds, and they were real companies, and they were those companies had typically, because there were market cap limits and things, so they had publicly traded securities. There were all the disclosures under the 34 Act in place. That all existed,
right.
And this was an adjunct to that. The advent of structured securities where there is no company, there is no issuer, this is a virtual portfolio built for the sole purpose of having people trading it. If we had been dealing with that, then I think the analysis might have been a little bit different. It just wasn't in the marketplace at the time, and that's why I say, I mean, just to prove, I'm as much vulnerable as a supervisor at the time as anyone else. That things you don't have a crystal ball, you don't know everything that will come along in the future, and you hope each generation of supervisors has to be on the ball and worried about what developments are happening and whether you know things that were sensible decisions at one point in time become less sensible if something changes, and you've got to constantly stay on top of it.
In particular, how would the analysis be different?
Well, and I don't know whether it would have resulted in any change in 144A.
Right.
I think the question of the reliance on the rating agencies and ratings and the nationally recognized system.
Right, NRSROs.
Yeah, right. Would have been different. You know, I think the rating agencies have done, for the most part, a decent job in rating companies, as much as I sometimes think they miss those too. But in the structured product area, I think that the conflicts of interest that are built into the people rating it, paying for the rating, just swamp the system. Models. It was all built not on observable life in a company that's doing business every day, but it's all built on theoretical models, and they were not equipped to do that job, and with a lot of damages. So whether we would have changed some of the preferences in ratings or changed 144A or, you know, other things, but I, had we been dealing with floods of unregistered securities of artificial entities that didn't have publicly traded securities against which you could. So one part of the whole philosophy of 144A was that, you know, these securities are securities of companies that all the public disclosures are there. This is just another series that is being sold quickly to an institutional buyer that's already up to speed on everything that is in the market. That's not the case if you have a newly created little virtual trust.
Okay. Thank you. These have been very helpful.
I have a short disclosure on 144A, not a question. I actually wrote a cover story. You probably don't even remember it, but if you do, I'm probably inviting criticism. I wrote a cover story for a magazine called Corporate Finance many years ago, and it was the title was 140. It was a cover story. 144A shakes the money tree. It was a photo of you shaking a money tree.
None of it landed on me.
None of it landed on you.
I don't. Yeah, the staff had. I didn't invent 144A all by myself. I mean, we did it during my tenure, and we wouldn't have done it if I didn't think it was a sensible rule. But the staff had spent a lot of time looking at this issue of, you know, trying to, as much as possible, reduce unnecessary liquidity penalties, and I think that was economically rational for us to worry about, you know, try and concern ourselves with, and I thought the rule was pretty sensible, and, but.
Can I ask a follow-up on AIG? You spent a few minutes talking about it, and, you know, we've heard and read different reasons for why AIG may have been supported. So among the investor community, you in particular, looking at it, you know, why do you think AIG got the support it did?
Oh, I assume that Secretary Paulson or Geithner were the decision makers had not had enough sleep. Probably, they were probably been up 72 hours without enough rest or panic.
That implies there was no preparation in advance for an event of this kind.
Well, I don't think we were into territory that nobody had preparations for. That much is clear. And I would not blame people for that. I mean, we did not have elaborate war games for the whole world melting down. I mean, it was that we were into territory of the unthinkable was unfolding in front of everybody's eyes. And I think had I been involved in making those decisions, I would have, I'm sure, like Paulson and Geithner, been acutely aware of the dangers of, if you know, we were able in Drexel to say, we're going to let it fail, go to bankruptcy court, we're going to reinforce market disciplines, because we knew we could. But I respected the New York Fed's point of view, and they were, you know, they didn't want to have to call up their central banking colleagues and tell them, remember those gold bars you used to have? They're in a bankruptcy court now. You might get them back. You might not. That wouldn't be a fun call. You need to take a taster with you next time you went to lunch at the, you know, at the Portuguese central bank. So I understood their position, but But there was no question of that you could have a global meltdown. I mean, it was just Drexel. It was an isolated, discrete problem. What Geithner and Paulson had to deal with was much, much worse. Many thousands of orders of magnitude because of the risk that you could have, you know, we did have waves of problems going on. Solomon was actually the greater risk of that, but Solomon was much, much larger than Drexel at the time, and when they had their problems, we were very much worried about what would happen if Solomon collapsed, and then, you know, people's books start unraveling, and you don't know who's most exposed. I think if a dispassionate analysis would say that AIG was a terrible mistake, at least in some ways. You know, when we were doing FIREA, I remember George Herbert Walker Bush, the President of the United States, at one point wagging his finger at me and telling me, now, as we constructed this, the one thing he wanted, he thought it was absolutely horrible that he was going to have to go to the American public and explain that we were going to have to finance the mistakes of bankers who made bad decisions, and it was their mistakes, and regulators who didn't prevent it, and the system didn't work as it should, and now you, the public, have to take money that ultimately should have gone for your kids and other family uses, and it's via taxing to the federal government eventually, you know, is going to pay for bankers' mistakes. And I remember him being very insistent that we had to design the whole system to do everything possible, both in how we handled it and how we changed the system in the future, to protect the public. And that if the public was going to pay, that it should be the minimum possible cost. And certainly the bankers and all their organizations had to pay first. And he didn't, that wasn't out of any sense of populism or anything. It was just, you know, how can I tell somebody who's a fireman or a teacher or just an ordinary person living out, trying to mind their own life, that they suddenly have to be taxed to pay for the mistakes of, you know, some big bank somewhere? And I think it was just basic common sense and basic decency, in a sense of, which of course is what the president as a person is like, mm-hmm. and certainly was, but built into the decision making. Now, you know, when you look at the AIG protecting the swap counterparties, well, if they hadn't done that, if they just said, you know, because people, had they wanted to swap from the regulated insurance companies within AIG, they could have gone and asked for contracts there. They were dealing with an unregulated subsidiary. They all knew it. It wasn't an insurance company. If it had been just allowed to close, then it might have been the case. It might or might not, but it's possible that some of the counterparties to those swap contracts, say Deutsche Bank, might have taken other risks relying on that swap contract, and if the swaps go away, they suddenly could be at risk of failure because the risks they took were too breathtaking and they relied on something they shouldn't have relied on, and now they need it to be. But had that happened, and there's no, you're making these decisions without knowing whether that's the case, well, if anyone's going to bail out Deutsche Bank, it should be the German taxpayers, not the American taxpayers. So AIG, by protecting the swap contracts, was an indirect bailout of all the big institutions on the planet being paid for solely by American taxpayers. And I'm absolutely of the view that, well, that certainly was starkly inconsistent with the general directions I got from the president when we were doing the savings loan things, was to minimize the cost to U.S. taxpayers. So, you know, that would have argued for saying at a minimum they have to take a haircut, and maybe an aggressive one, recognizing that if Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank or Barclays or Santander or Mitsubishi Bank or anybody around the world proves to then be at risk of failure because of that, well, then their government will need to deal with that, including us, if it happens to be, you know, an American bank. Now, the counter-argument to that would have been that we don't have time, and the dominoes are falling too fast, and we can't predict where that will happen, and yes, that sounds theoretically nice, but it might not work, and, you know, if the avalanche comes down the mountain too fast, it may sweep everybody away. And that's more important than saving a few billion dollars in the cost of gratuitous windfalls to counterparties of an AIG derivative subsidiary. And maybe you guys will get to the bottom of that. Maybe it'll take 100 years of history to reach that conclusion. But I know there were less expensive alternatives. They weren't taken. It's similar to the argument of the TARP money that was pushed on people who said, I don't need it, I don't want it. And, well, you know, for the good of the country, you all need to take taxpayer money. If some people taking it, everybody should take it. Because otherwise people will have a stigma to the people who needed it. Well, the people who needed it should have a stigma. I mean, this was one of the problems in the savings and loans was protecting the weakest. And the system and the regulators at that time, in all their decisions about accounting policies and writing down assets, it was always to protect the weakest. But it weakened the whole system then, and you ultimately dragged down the strongest. And so,
can I ask you a question as a sophisticated market participant? I'd like your view on one of the things we've heard vis-a-vis the paying out the AIG counterparties is that it had less to do with paying back the counterparties than just keeping the commercial paper market afloat, that AIG was a dominant player in the commercial paper market, and that the Fed was very concerned about signaling to that market that AIG could falter in any way on any obligation. And as a significant stakeholder in that market, that it was important for the Fed to send the message that, again, AIG could not falter. As a sophisticated market participant,
First of all, if that's true, then AIG shouldn't be a private company. I mean, it should be regulated as a public utility, and there should be very strict limits on the risks it's allowed to take. And I have no problem. If you want to define something as essential, a public utility in capital markets, then you should regulate it as such. You cannot say you're allowed to go out and do whatever you want because you're an unregulated subsidiary, but if you blow yourself up, you are so critical, we're going to make the taxpayers pay for you. I mean, I don't understand that dichotomy. So if that was true, then they made a mistake early on not saying this needs to be brought inside some regulatory structure, and insurance, of course, being the one major market that is outside federal supervision, not that federal supervision has covered itself in glory in the last few years. But so I would, at one point, I would, one response. Second is, you know, commercial paper markets do freeze up. I mean, when Penn Central failed, the commercial paper market just stopped for a while. People didn't know what to. It was the AIG of its day, and not because of counterparty risk, but it was just a big, well-known institution and with problems. And so, okay, so if you can't issue commercial paper, then you have to figure out your liquidity need somewhere else. Commercial paper is a nice thing. I've been on the boards of lots of companies that have issued commercial paper, and I've been on the board of one of them that, in the midst of all this, then couldn't issue commercial paper. And so no company should organize and structure itself on the assumption that commercial paper markets will be open 365 days a year and that you as a company will always be able to borrow from them, because that is demonstrably not true. So shame on anyone if that were the case. I think there is something, a tendency, and I think there's a tendency, and my story about Drexel is a reflection of it. If you are in the business, if you're the department of too big to fail, you will find that more companies are too big to fail than somebody else will. It's in the just nature of bureaucracies, I think. If your power and mystique as an institution in part comes because you orchestrate these big rescues in the middle of the night, you'll do it too often. And every time you do it, you create massive, uncontrollable amounts of moral hazard. Because people get used to the idea then of saying, well, if it's big, the government won't let it fail, and therefore I can take risks with it that aren't prudent for me to take, and I can expose myself. Whereas if I knew that thing could fail, I've got to be more careful. Fannie and Freddie being the ultimate examples, perhaps, of that, but AIG certainly unleashed. I mean, we would be dealing for 20 years with a less risky swaps market if people in AIG had incurred some losses. They don't have to be down to zero. And the Fed was probably smart to say, I do agree that you shouldn't have had a Lehman bankruptcy in a market of that kind where nobody could get anything for years. That could have caused unnecessary economic damage. But if they had said, we're going to protect up to 50%, and you can come tell us if you need more, we'll talk then and we'll send the bill to your country, that would have prevented the total illiquidity but imposed losses on people who had imprudently relied on AIG as a counterparty that didn't have the balance sheet to make good on its obligations. And instead, the lesson we taught the whole world was, well, if it's a really big mess, American taxpayers will step in and borrow Chinese money to solve the problem. And we could have done it in a cheaper way. And so I don't quarrel with... It's way too easy for me as a private citizen to sit there and second-guess the people who were in the... who were trying to stop the avalanche. And I give huge, great credit to the people who were there, and they did prevent a repeat of 1933. And thank goodness for all of us, they did. So, you could be Monday morning quarterback, but I wouldn't want anything I said to not recognize that these guys were facing something that no one on their staffs could realistically measure the magnitude of the damage, and if you were wrong, the magnitude of the consequences. And so, did they err on the side of safety in a time where I didn't have to worry about that in Drexel because it was just one firm, and I didn't, no matter what happened, that kind of risk could not get unleashed. So I think they did things that they felt they had to do, and all that's well and good. But now when you step back and say, how do we try and prevent that? And in FIREA, we tried to do some things to require something to have less discretion. Just to make the point, it's a little overstatement, but we could, for example, make it a felony punishable by 10 years in prison for any officer of the Federal Reserve or the United States Treasury to pay a debt that is not a contractual obligation. I know when I was chairman of the SEC, if we spent money, there was a thing called the Anti-Deficiency Act, and if Congress appropriated $100 million and we spent $100 million and won, I went to jail. I'm not allowed to spend money that was beyond appropriations. Why is it that we have this totally unlimited discretion on the part of people of the Fed to sort of basically jump in and monetize any situation that they see? Now, there are some laws, I'm overstating that a little bit. Well, thank goodness they have discretion when you need it, but having too much discretion may mean it gets used too often, which means you create more moral hazard, which means that the next time you may face something that even all the intervention in the world can't stop. And at some point, having everybody in the market know that, well, there are limits to what they can do. No, you can schmooze them up one side and down the other, and you've got them convinced, and they love you and everything else, but guess what? I've got this provision here that says, if I pay you federal funds for something you don't have a contractual right to, I go to jail, and so, hey, I'm not going to do that. And, well, that forces a restructuring of expectations in the marketplace and forces people to look around, well, okay, who has a contract? Who has legitimate claims? Versus just these things off in the ether of, well, let's throw some money at it. And I wouldn't suggest that we adopt that felony yet, but there is a systemic problem of too many bailouts, too often, too easy, and not enough consequences. And I mean, the public reaction is sensible in the sense of, and to couple the AIG bailout and all these windfalls and the cost of all that with then the bonuses being paid out without limits. If they'd been forced to go into a bankruptcy court, those bonus contracts would now become claims in a bankruptcy. They wouldn't be money good. And the traders were the people who would have had to go into the bankruptcy judge and explain why, you know, the company would have needed the authority to pay how much of them. I served as corporate monitor in WorldCom, where we had a company of kind of the size of AIG, and when it went into trouble, guess what? Because it was in bankruptcy, the claims for executive bonuses all came before a judge who said, sorry, we'll pay some of them. We don't want you to lose all your key people, but you needed public assistance. So all those contracts were, you know, that's fine as long as you can pay for it, but you can't. And so now those become claims and not money good. So I think there was a lot of to me, I hope people really study AIG hard and figure out, was there a better way? You know, when I read in one story, there was, I forget her name, but a senior vice president of the New York Fed sitting in the room when the company's comp committee was meeting and reviewing some of the bonuses. And it was a terrible mistake. Because if a Fed official is sitting in the room when that comp committee is meeting and there's a proposal with a bunch of bonuses on the table and the Fed person conspicuously sits there and doesn't open their mouth, all the other board members are going to say, that's a message. Fed says this is okay. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they weren't intending to send that message, but that's the way it would be read. And where the Fed has already intervened and they're the gorilla in the room, now the board is not going to function as it might otherwise function.
They need the room, I guess, for the next person in the hot seat. But if you want to, we would love to hear more from you, but it looks like we're at about 1 o'clock. So
thank you all so much.
You keep your answer short to this. The CSE program, were you tuned into that at all, the Consolidated Supervisory Entities that they created? Is that a program you like to?
It was the 2004 change to the alternative net capital rule. I think you've spoken some about the fact that
raising the leverage
didn't go well.
Okay.
That was a picture that should have been left in the bullpen. Well, thank you.